Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from UPR. Today on the program, a bill to prevent doctors from providing gender-affirming care to transgender youth advances at the legislature as crowds rally for transgender health care at the Utah Capitol. A domestic violence database could prevent more violence in Utah. And a controversial school voucher bill passes the Utah legislature. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporters Emily Anderson Stern and Jacob Scholl, reporter Courtney Tanner, and news columnist Robert Gerke. You can join the live conversation this week by email to upraccess@gmail.com. That's upraccess@gmail.com or on Twitter at upraccess. Let's welcome in everybody. Jacob Scholl, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be talking on tape with Courtney Tanner, recorded that yesterday. She'll be joining us recorded. News columnist Robert Gerke, thanks for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. And State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Let's start with you, Emily. So we want to talk about a rally that happened, and also, I guess, a bill that failed, and then there's a bill that's advancing through the legislature. I guess tell us first of all about the bill that failed.
Yeah. So the bill that failed is one that was introduced by Representative Rex Shipp of Cedar City, and that one. You know, that one was a little more strict than the one that ended up passing on transgender healthcare. It had an absolute ban on any transgender healthcare, including surgeries and hormone therapy, and it penalized doctors if they were to administer such healthcare.
So what are the concerns? Why did the representative run the bill? And I guess it'd be similar concerns as to why Senator Mike Kennedy's bill is advancing.
Yeah, so, I mean, let me describe a little bit how Senator Mike Kennedy's bill is a little bit different. So it also bans, you know, surgeries, gender-affirming surgeries for minors, but it's enacts a moratorium instead on prescribing hormone treatments. That moratorium... During that moratorium, the Utah Department of Health and Human Services will study data on the use of those medications. And that seems to be what, you know, Republicans didn't like about Representative Shipp's bill, was that there was no study. Representative Ray Ward of Bountiful, he's actually a physician himself. He told House Health and Human Services Committee, that he didn't think, you know, that hormone therapy is a closed issue, and that he, before he, you know, voted on an absolute ban on hormone therapy for transgender minors, he wanted to see more of a study and more data on whether or not those treatments are harmful to young people.
So tell me, maybe remind us, give us some particulars on Senator Kennedy's bill. What it seems to be moving, did it pass the, I think I read it passed the Senate.
Yes.
Yeah, but tell us what it would do exactly.
So it would, put a moratorium on hormone therapy for transgender minors and ban surgeries for transgender minors. And during the moratorium, there would be a study on hormone therapy. But yeah, like you said, it passed the Senate, and then yesterday it got its final vote in the House. And so now it moves on to the governor for his signature.
It passed the House as well. Okay. Has the governor indicated one way or the other, the way he leans?
Fox 13 actually ran into the governor at the Capitol yesterday and asked him about it. And he said he doesn't plan on vetoing the bill. He said he doesn't think it's perfect, but he doesn't get to write the bills. But there, you know, it doesn't look like there's much hope for critics that it will be vetoed. Our I do want to say my colleague Brian Shaw has also done a lot of great reporting on this issue. And yesterday he reported that the Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel, which, you know, often will look at the legislature's bills and say whether, you know, they're legal, whether they're constitutional, whether they might be subject to a lawsuit. He obtained an analysis from that office that said, you know, it's likely going to be, there are likely going to be lawsuits against this bill. So.
I'm trying to search for the word emotional testimony as these bills were being considered. And a rally, of course, at the state capitol. I think the rally was mostly intended against restrictions on care for transgender teens, right, youth. Tell me, first of all, maybe give me some flavor of testimony and statements in favor of these bills. In other words, restricting hormone treatment, et cetera, for transgender youth.
There was, you know, one young person from California who's, her name's Chloe Cole. She's pretty well known when it comes to these kinds of conversations. She was an expert witness for both bills. She talked about how, you know, when she was younger, around 13, she transitioned with, you know, at the time she identified as a male. And then, you know, she detransitioned, and she, you know, says that it was harmful to her, that she has medical issues because of that process. But she was used as a witness for both bills, talking about the potential harms of some of these treatments. And there were also there was also a woman from Logan, up in your neck of the woods. Her name's Erin Brewer. She's the co-founder of a group called Advocates Protecting Children. And she runs a blog that criticizes a lot of transgender rights movements. But she, you know, talks about her story where she said she was a former transgender kid. And she says that, you know, she feels that her transgender identity when she was younger came from a traumatic experience she had when she was sexually assaulted. And she said she, you know, went to a therapist and then realized that for her, that was a reaction to being sexually assaulted. So she says, you know, if she'd received these treatments as a young person, she wouldn't have been able to, I guess, find that healing. But there were a lot more people who came and spoke in opposition to the bills. A lot of transgender young people who said, you know, that hormone therapy and various gender affirming care, has saved their lives. You know, being transgender was very difficult for them. And when they, you know, were able to receive those treatments, it made life a lot easier.
I'll just mention there was a dramatic scene. Representative Quinn Cotter, a Republican, brought a Bible in and, you know, quoted the Bible. Dramatic. And then there were a lot of thumbs down gestures, you report, from other people. But I guess religious grounds would be, I don't know if anybody else cited religious grounds for their support for these bills.
There were a couple people who came up and gave testimony entirely on religious grounds, you know, saying some transphobic things like, you know, there are males and females and what you're born as is what you are and there's nothing else. And, you know, quoting from the Bible. And the reaction in the audience was people were scoffed at it and were not rolled their eyes. They were not too happy. A lot of the folks were attending. Mm-hmm.
What were some other arguments against these bills that you heard a lot from the rally? But I guess similar views would have been expressed in these hearings.
Yeah, and I do want to say my colleague, Pollock Chasewell, she did some really great reporting on the rally. That a lot of the folks who spoke at the rally spoke at the hearings, too. And, you know, these hearings earlier this week were the last time the public really got to comment on these bills before lawmakers passed them. There was the editor of the student newspaper at West High School, Bree Martin, came and shared her story. And she called the gender affirming care nothing short of life-saving. She said, you know, she felt privileged and lucky to have been able to transition before she was an adult, because a lot of times, you know, making that kind of, receiving that kind of care as an adult after puberty can be a lot more difficult. She ended her remarks saying, "I deserve a body to feel proud of," and received applause from the crowd, which was, you know, the committee wasn't very happy about that because they try to have decorum in the meetings. But there were a number of heartbreaking stories. I don't know if, you know, if folks saw the pictures that have gone around from the rally. Our photographer Trent Nelson took a, you know, beautiful and heartbreaking photo of a mother hugging her transgender child. His name's Oliver Day, and he talks about how when he was younger and realized he was transgender, it was difficult for him, and, you know, he didn't feel comfortable in his body, and he ended up, you know, turning to self-harm because of how uncomfortable he was in his body. He talked about how, you know, he has permanent scars from that, and how he developed an eating disorder so that he could appear more manly. And he said as soon as he went on testosterone, he finally felt like he was being heard. He felt like he was himself.
I want to talk to you, Emily, about your recent story on abortion as well. But before we do that briefly, let's turn to Robert Gerke for commentary on what we've just been talking about.
Thanks, Tom. You know, I think this is a real sad event in the legislature, and it's one of several this session already that just feels like they're ignoring the best interests of the people that they think they're trying to protect. I mean, the spin they put on it was that kids can't make these decisions, but I don't think that's the place for a group of predominantly white male LDS legislators to be making either. And you know, I guess maybe you could say it's, you know, if the child is 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, then maybe you could make the argument. But when you're talking about teenagers, in some cases late teenagers, you know, they're figuring this out themselves, and it is difficult, and they have enough challenges in front of them already. And I hate to see this happen. You know, as Emily kind of characterized the testimony, and from what I heard from the committee hearings, it was overwhelmingly the Utahns who were testifying were overwhelmingly, you know, parents and these kids who say that it's changed their life, it's saved their life, and it's made them more productive, happier, and you know, there really wasn't a contingent of people who regretted this or are suffering health issues from it. And so, you know, and the medical community was pretty overwhelmingly, from Emily can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I saw, the doctors who testified were, you know, they dispelled some of the myths about this treatment, I think. But the legislature didn't really care about that. This was an agenda-driven thing. And you know it's an agenda-driven thing because we're seeing it happen in every red state around the country. And it's unfortunate that we're joining them. And I guess if there are listeners out there who, you know youths, who have kids in their lives who are going through this or, you know, considering going through this, just try to be there for them, because it's insulting and cruel to these kids to see the elected officials who are supposed to be representing them doing this sort of thing.
Emily Anderson Stern, before we go to break, I want to have you just very briefly talk about your another story that was published this week. The headline is "Why Utah Republicans Want More Abortion Restrictions." You're talking not only about legislators, but federal officials as well. Tell me a little bit about what's been going on.
Yeah, so, you know, Mitt Romney and Mike Lee recently got behind a bill that would prohibit any federal funds from going toward abortion. And that includes any, you know, federally subsidized insurance plans provided through the Affordable Care Act. So in states where abortion is legal, if someone, you know, has someone who's low income has an insurance plan through the Affordable Care Act that's subsidized by the government, they wouldn't be able to get coverage for an abortion. Attorney General Sean Reyes has also, and a couple of national issues put his name in opposition to some efforts from the federal government to expand abortion access. One of those is the FDA recently finalized a rule that allows women in states where abortion is legal to obtain abortion pills remotely. They can meet with a telehealth provider and get the prescription, and then the prescription can be sent to their home, pretty similar to a lot of other prescriptions. He and a group of other attorneys general sent a letter to the FDA voicing their opposition to that and saying that they're ignoring women's health because of the risks of the drug. The FDA already has a process in place where they explain the risks to women. And then he also signed an amicus brief in a federal case in Texas. In which, the VA recently approved a rule where they will start providing abortion counseling and abortion in cases of where the woman's life is at risk, or when in cases of rape or incest. And in Texas, the rape or incest exception is not one that they have in their law. Abortion is still banned in those cases. And so a nurse practitioner who works for the VA there, is suing the on religious grounds, saying that, she shouldn't have to provide these abortions, and also saying that, because it's illegal in Texas, it puts her in legal jeopardy. And Attorney General Reyes is signed onto an amicus brief backing that.
Very good. Emily Anderson Stern, State Watch reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you'll join us for the Underplayed Stories of the Week this week in about 10 minutes, a little earlier in the program. Robert Gerke, any brief commentary on the movement on abortion?
Yeah, it's not too surprising, right? I mean, this has been a movement that ever since the Dobbs decision, we've seen states trying to outdo each other and trying to restrict access. I worry that we're losing sight of the important issues here. I mean, in an almost religious zeal for political purposes, it's hard to see. These are issues that are playing out in Utah and all across the country, obviously. This move to restrict access. I think it's encouraging to see people stepping up and finding new ways to try to expand access, to healthcare procedure. We haven't seen the last of it. It's going to keep playing out all over the country.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. So we have with us State Watch reporters Emily Anderson Stern and Jacob Scholl. Later, we'll hear a recorded conversation with reporter Courtney Tanner. We have news columnist Robert Gerke as well. We'll go to break now.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams, and we're talking with State Watch reporters Emily Anderson Stern and Jacob Scholl, reporter Courtney Tanner, and news columnist Robert Gerke. We turn next to Jacob Scholl. Jacob, we want to talk about your recent story about a potential domestic violence database in Utah, SB 117. Who's the sponsor, and what would this do, Jacob?
Yeah, so the sponsor of this bill is Senator Todd Weiler of Woods Cross. And essentially, this bill would do two things. So one, it would create a database for police to use of domestic violence incidents. So this would include incidents that might not have resulted in an arrest, but nonetheless, definitely categorized as a call regarding domestic violence. And essentially that would be potentially beneficial to police, just knowing if certain places that they're going into, you know, if they're dealing with the same people over and over again, whether that's in different parts of the state or anything like that, they would have that kind of resources. And I know advocates have kind of praise this because, you know, this would be able, this would be one way to essentially keep track of, you know, certain people to see if situations are escalating and, you know, potentially getting more violent. So it's just more of a resource for police. And then the second aspect of this bill would essentially would be to mandate police officers to conduct what is called a lethality assessment program. And it's essentially, it's just a list of questions that police would be required to ask survivors of domestic violence to essentially get a gauge of not only their potential danger level, but also just, you know, how they are perceiving their threats. So, you know, part of this lethality assessment program, essentially the first three questions are along the lines of, you know, has your partner ever threatened to kill you? Do they have access to weapons? You know, do you feel your life is at risk? That sort of thing. And with this program, you know, there's, I think, 11 questions total. And if you meet a certain criteria, this also kicks in. But if a survivor meets the criteria, for example, if they answer that, yes, you know, their life has been threatened by their partner before, police would then immediately connect them with whatever resource services are available. So that could be counseling, that could be emergency housing, that could be, you know, connecting them to a shelter for survivors of domestic violence, that sort of thing. So that's kind of the two main things that the SB 117 would do.
There's a tragic incident that was testified of. Unfortunately, our lieutenant governor has a connection to. Could you tell me that story, how it connects to this bill?
Yeah, so Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson has, she's been working with Senator Todd Weidler for you know, the past few months on this bill. This bill is kind of the culmination of their work. But for Henderson, it's really a personal tragedy. So back in August, I believe it was August 17th, her cousin, Mandy Main, was shot and killed while she waited for a bus in Taylorsville. And the shooter was Mandy Main's ex-husband, who was a convicted felon, you know, should not have had access to a firearm. And that sort of thing. But, you know, nonetheless, that's still what happened. And then, you know, shortly after, I believe police discovered shortly after that the ex had, fatally shot himself not far away from where Mandy Main was killed. But anyway, since then, Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson has really made a push to, you know, essentially beef up the state's resources when it comes to domestic violence. So this, you know, she testified in support of the bill earlier this week alongside Mandy Main's parents, Kent and Shauna Main. So they are, you know, the parents are still very much in support of this bill. I believe Kent Main was saying during his testimony that he's not 100% sure that, you know, mandating this kind of, you know, mandating the lethality assessment protocol or program, excuse me, from being asked, you know, he said he's not exactly sure if that would have saved his daughter, but that's, you know, it's certainly a missed opportunity and something that could potentially have helped her and, you know, will almost certainly help other people in the state.
What's been the experience? What's the data on lethality assessment programs? Is it effective, I guess?
Well, during the meeting on Tuesday, multiple members of law enforcement testified, including a police officer from Woods Cross, which I apologize, I can't recall his name off the top of my head. One thing that Senator Wyler was talking about was, he's obviously a resident of Woods Cross, and the Woods Cross Police Department was one of the first agencies to actually bring in this lethality assessment program. And that's the other thing too, is that it's more commonly referred to as LAP, but LAP questions are already being used in Utah, but it's voluntarily through police departments. So but again, this bill would require it statewide. During this officer's testimony, he said that, several years ago when they first implemented this sort of plan, they conducted everything. The survivor that they were talking to essentially said, answered yes to all the questions and said, yes, my life has been threatened. My life, my children have been threatened, and that sort of thing. And to make a long story short, essentially, that person was taken to a shelter, and not long after, the other spouse in that relationship, tried to show up at the house with a firearm, and that person died shortly thereafter from a self-inflicted wound. So essentially, this officer's testimony was that, one of the first cases that they implemented this sort of LAP program could have potentially saved lives just right off the bat. So I know that's a bit anecdotal, but a lot of the testimony earlier this week really, really reflected that. There were multiple members of law enforcement that spoke very highly of this program.
So what's the status of Senate Bill 117 at this point?
Yeah, so it was approved unanimously in Senate committee on Tuesday. I believe it's still on the Senate side. I don't believe it's gone to a full vote in the House, but just judging from the support it has received so far, I can't imagine it would take very long for a bill like this to, get a vote in the Senate and presumably go to the House.
Well, very good. I have one more story I'd want to treat briefly with you, Jacob. But before we do that, I want to get some commentary on this from Robert Gerke.
It's encouraging, I guess, that we're addressing this issue, because domestic violence is one of the leading causes of murder and murder-suicide in the country and in the state. So, anything that we can do that's going to help avoid, these tragedies, I think, is encouraging. I think ultimately we should be moving in the direction of some red flag laws, because you put a gun into one of these situations and we end up with bad outcomes. And unfortunately, the legislature has been unwilling to do that for the last several years. I think that's the direction we need to be looking and doing what we can to keep firearms out of the hands of domestic violence perpetrators. And keeping them out of the middle of these volatile situations. So it's a good step forward. I think there's going to need to be more done to try to help save lives down the road.
So, Jacob, I just wanted get this out here. There's an editor's note at the end of your story here. I think it's important. I'll just read this. Utah Domestic Violence Link line is 800-897-LINK. So 800-897-LINK. Utah Rape and Sexual Assault Crisis Line is 888-421-1100. 888-421-1100. So, Jacob Scholl, the other thing we want to talk to you about is essentially a new position you have. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I will be, I guess I already am, the Northern Utah reporter for both the Tribune and your station, Utah Public Radio. So, I will be reporting on Northern Utah, specifically in the Cache Valley. I, as someone who lives in Ogden, I kind of consider Northern Utah as, Weber, Davis, Box Elder, Cache, Morgan, Ridge counties, all that area. So I will be, not only reporting for the Tribune in print and online, but I will also be producing radio stories for UPR.
Well, that's exciting. We're happy to have you on board, and we're happy to get this partnership going, Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio. Jacob Scholl, you'll stay with us briefly, about 5 minutes here, or 3 minutes. We'll get the underplayed stories of the week. Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we get to the underplayed stories of the week, Robert Gerke, I wanted to, I'll have you give the Reader's Digest version, the Cliff Notes version of your story about cutting down trees. Give me the minute version of this.
Yeah, it stems from a letter that was written by Salt Lake County Councilwoman Dia Theodore. I think we talked about it on the program a couple weeks ago, actually. But the letter suggests that, you know, if we're looking for ways to conserve water and save the Great Salt Lake, one of those ways might be to cut down trees in the forest. And it struck me as kind of an odd, sort of unconventional thinking. But there is some logic to it, right? You've got, if trees are sucking water out of the ground, if you have fewer trees, logically, you might have less water. And it actually has been sort of the conventional wisdom in forestry going back to the 60s. But, you know, I talked to some experts here in Utah, forest ecologists and researcher with the U.S. Forest Service up in Logan, who said, you know, that the research that was done that sort of led to that thinking was all done sort of in wetter climates, higher elevations, wetter climates, cooler climates. When you actually look at Utah and at more arid climates like we have here, it doesn't necessarily hold up, and you can actually end up with less water coming out of the forests into the streams if you do cut down these trees, because you know, they provide shade, and it's sort of a common sense thing, right? If you've been in a forest, if you're in the shade, it's cooler there. But when you get that extra additional sunlight, you end up with the potential that more water is going to evaporate off the, you know, from the ground. And you lose water in that circumstance. So what the consensus was for the, among these people who had researched the topic that I talked to, is that it's really not, I mean, in on the margins, if you do it right at high elevations, you might be able to squeeze a little bit more water out. But you also run the risk, if you do it wrong, of actually exacerbating the problem. And what they, you know, and that's not to say they all agreed as well, though, that there can be benefits to taking better care of forests, making sure they're not overgrown. And, you know, among the most obvious, I guess, is you don't have catastrophic wildfires, which obviously can affect runoff and groundwater as well. But among the reasons to actually do these forest treatments, the conservation of water is really not a good one.
Well, let's turn to the underplayed stories of the week. Let's start with Emily Anderson Stern. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Mine is one from Sophia Jeremias. She wrote about a greenhouse that used to, you know, have survival gear in it that's been turned into a resource for Utahns experiencing homelessness.
Yeah, it's a great story. SLTrib.com to find that. Jacob Scholl, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I think this might stem from the fact that, you know, I used to cover courts, and I can always appreciate a good court story. But earlier this week, our colleague Brian Maffley wrote about how a lawsuit against a BYU professor was dismissed, and essentially this BYU scientist by the name of Ben Abbott has been a leading critic of the efforts to dredge Utah Lake, and he was sued for defamation by Lake Restoration Solutions, which is the company who is trying to dredge Utah Lake, and for, you know, their potential gain. But earlier this week, a judge threw out that lawsuit and essentially called it frivolous and an abuse of the legal system. So I think that's a story that is worth bringing more attention to.
Okay. And Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I like Jacob's story, too. That's a good one. My story is also a Brian Maffley story. It's about new research that shows that one polluter, U.S. magnesium, could be responsible for more than 10% of the fine particulate pollution that we get in along the Wasatch Front. You know, this is new research from NOAA. And it's, you know, we've known for a long time they've been a polluter. This is looking at some different emissions that, you know, maybe hadn't been tracked as closely as they should, and they're trying to decide if they need to go back and reassess those. So, you know, when we're in these winter months and we get these inversions, and it's a topic on everybody's mind. So I think it's worth checking out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com. I'll just mention briefly two stories from Blake Apgar, State of the County and State of the City, Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City. Check those out, sltrib.com. Well, Robert Gerke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
Thank you. Emily Anderson Stern, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jacob Scholl, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. More following this break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. This part of the program, we're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, welcome to the program.
Hey there.
This has been a very busy week for you. A lot has happened with the school voucher proposal, House Bill 215. Let's cut to the chase here. I think people will know. It's not a secret that we have to keep till the end. House Bill 215 has passed the legislature. Is that correct?
That's right. It passed Thursday by a 20-8 vote in the Senate. That was the final vote.
Now, as you pointed out in a story ahead of that time, I think that means both House and Senate, two-thirds majorities. If that's the case, what does that mean?
Right. So there's this provision in Utah law that's really important here. Anytime both the House and the Senate vote with a two-thirds majority on a bill, then it's referendum proof, which means that residents can't try to recall the bill. They can't, like, launch a public initiative to put it on the ballot and try to get that law repealed.
That's especially relevant because I think it was 2007, there was a previous voucher bill passed, I believe, and the residents didn't like that. They got up an initiative and passed it, right?
That is spot on, yeah. So we saw that in 2007 where, you know, the Republican majority legislature here passed a similar voucher bill and, you know, residents didn't like it. And they did have the opportunity at that point to run a referendum, and their referendum worked, and they got the law repealed. About 62% of folks voted to repeal that.
So the bill now goes to the governor for his signature. I think he has signaled he's in favor of this bill.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting switch this week. So last year when the proposal was ran by Representative Candace Barucci, the governor had said that he would veto it. He was pushing for teacher salary increases and said, you know, if the starting teacher salary isn't at $60,000 in the state, I really don't think that we should be doing voucher programs. And so he had threatened to veto it, didn't end up coming down to that. The bill failed in the House last year. But this year, obviously, as we know, the bill kind of barreled through the legislature and it passed in both bodies. And now Governor Cox has said that he does support this measure, even though the starting teacher salary is not at $60,000 yet, like he had hoped. He was happy to see that a teacher raise was actually tied into this bill, this voucher bill. So teachers will get a $6,000 salary and benefit raise along with this voucher proposal. So they're kind of made contingent on each other.
The governor originally, I guess last year, had that $60,000 mark. What would this $6,000 raise put an average teacher at?
Yeah, everyone has kind of different factors. The bottom line is we're not at $60,000. Some folks, some organizations put us at about $45,000 for an average starting salary. Some put it a little higher than that. Some put it at like $50,000. But if you add in the increase, which is actually $4,200 in salary and $1,800 in benefits, so it ends up being smaller in salary than it looks. But at the max, it would put the average starting teacher salary at about $54,000. That would be a high point, but maybe somewhere between $50,000 and $55,000 for an average starting salary in the state.
So earlier in the week, you filed a story, Everything You Need to Know About Utah's Latest Voucher Proposal, and you posed some questions here. So I'm just going to go through your story and ask you those questions, if that's okay. So what are vouchers generally, and how do they work?
Yes, vouchers. This is, something that we're all kind of learning this week, especially if you weren't around in 2007 when the previous proposal came around. Vouchers have all these different ways that they can operate in different names for them. Some people call them tax credits. Some people call them tax rebates, education savings accounts. There's all these kind of different names for them. This proposal is called a scholarship, for example. But the gist of it is that you essentially take taxpayer funding and you kind of set it aside in this fund, and then you allow students to be granted scholarships or vouchers to use some of that fund to cover attendance at a private school or to do homeschooling.
So Representative Pierucci's bill, House Bill 215, in addition to giving teachers raises, it will now establish the Utah Fits All Scholarship. What will this do?
So this scholarship is an $8,000 award per student. So a student can apply to this program and essentially be granted up to $8,000 if they want to go to a private school. That can be a student that's already in public school that wants to move to a private school or move to homeschooling. That could be a student that's already doing private school or homeschooling. There's actually no restriction on that. But essentially, they get this award to fund their education outside of the public education system.
How similar is this to the one that passed in 2007?
Fairly similar. I mean, I think that this is fair to say it's peeled back a little bit. There are more kind of guardrails in place in this one. So, for instance, a student can't just use this money on anything, right? So, like, there are kind of lists in the bill of what they could use the money on. Like, if they're being homeschooled, there are, like, reasonable expenses that a student can use it on, for instance. And there's, like, audits that are required every year. And at the end of the year, a student has to either submit a portfolio of what they learned during the year or do an opt-in assessment. And those were kind of put in place as this bill has been negotiated. For instance, those weren't in the bill last year, but they are this year because there's been some negotiations. I mean, it kind of depends on who you ask. A lot of teacher groups in the state and Democrats in both the House and Senate are feeling frustrated and feeling like they weren't a part of the negotiations, but those are some of the things that have been added to this bill.
Now, understand that you can't take this money and go to a charter school because a charter school is a public school.
Yeah, that's a big misconception that people have. It's very good to clarify. Charter schools are public schools. So you have, your traditional K through 12 neighborhood schools, which are public, and then charters are kind of a way to introduce more freedom and choice into the public system itself. So charters can have kind of slightly different models, but they are still kind of governed by the state.
So I think Representative Pierucci floated this a similar bill last year. It didn't go anywhere. And in fact, the governor wasn't on board then. What does she say and other supporters say what has changed in a year?
She says that there's been this kind of push since the pandemic for parents to have more say in how their child's educated. So she says, there were all these parents that were upset with how the public system worked. There were parents that didn't want their kids in math. There were parents that didn't want their kids learning online, and they wanted other options. And there is data that shows that kind of at the peak of the pandemic in 2020, there were all of these kids that did try homeschooling and private schooling, when COVID was at its highest. But the data also shows that all of those students returned back, most of those students returned back to their traditional public schools in 2021. So it kind of remains to be seen what's pushing this. There is kind of general Republican sense that there should be more competition within education and that this kind of lets that play out, private versus public. And then Representative Pierucci says there's also just this kind of, sense among legislators to try to reinvent education a little bit. So
give me the details again, how much money and that would serve up to how many students?
So it's $42 million total for the voucher part of this. It's $200 million for the teacher salaries. But with the voucher part, after some administration costs are essentially worked out, they think it'll serve maybe up to 5,000 students. There is an opportunity for some students. This was another addition to the bill kind of late in the game, but some students can do public school like half time and then private tutoring the other half, and those students would get a partial scholarship instead of the full $8,000. So total, they're thinking somewhere around 5,000 students served.
Oh, so give me some of the arguments in favor, and then I'll have you give me the contrary arguments. What are proponents of this saying? And I guess they're pleased it's passed. What are they saying? Why? And what will they think this will do?
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement among proponents who say, you know, just give people more choice to find a classroom that works for their kids. You know, they say that one size doesn't fit all in public education, that there are kids who struggle in public schools and might have a better opportunity in a private school. And so they're excited about the chance to try that. They also say, you know, that this money will help families explore that choice. So the bill does prioritize lower income students who apply to give them the scholarship kind of ahead of other students who may have the means to go to a private school. So they're excited, you know, that essentially that it expands choices for them.
There are opponents, right? A majority of the Utah School Board, I think, opposed this. Teachers unions, Utah PTA. What are opponents saying?
You're right. Just about every education stakeholder in the state has opposed this. The largest teachers union, I mean, there's been a bunch of teachers that have spoken out. There's been student and teacher walkouts, the State Board of Education. I mean, the list goes on and on. And the list of concerns goes on and on, too. Probably the biggest one is that currently the state allocates about $4,000 a year per student that goes to public school. And this proposal takes about $8,000 of taxpayer money to send a student to private school. So they're frustrated that it feels like the state is giving double the amount of money for a student to leave public schools. They feel like, you know, public schools are pretty critically underfunded in Utah, and then this feels like a step to kind of undermine that. There's also concerns that private schools in Utah are not regulated. They don't have to hire licensed teachers, for instance. They don't have any kind of set curriculum, and they don't have to serve students with disabilities. And then probably the last major concern is that private school tuition averages about $11,000 in the state, which would leave about a $3,000 gap that families would have to cover, which these opponents say, you know, if you're really trying to serve low-income families, those families can't cover that difference, so you're not going to be serving them in the end.
I noticed there were some Republicans opposing this, and they, at least some of them, tended to be rural. Why are rural folks opposing this?
That's an important part of this, too, yeah. So the private schools in Utah are really concentrated on the Wasatch Front. Most zip codes of the state don't have a private school in them. So St. George is kind of an anomaly in that because it's, you know, a bigger area in the Wasatch Front has these private schools, but pretty much everywhere else just doesn't have them. So these rural legislators, these Republicans that have kind of stood against it have said, look, you're not expanding choice in my area. You know, our public schools are our community, and we want to support those.
Would this apply to homeschool? You could get a voucher for homeschool?
You can, right. Mm-hmm. So it does private school, and there's an option if you want to do homeschooling.
By the way, you had a figure in your story. National Center for Education Statistics estimated roughly 3% of K-12 students go to Utah enrolled in private institutions. So, you know, kind of a small percentage, potentially if it's private school.
That's right. So about 3% going to private school, maybe 2%-ish going to homeschooling. So you're looking at essentially 95% of students that are in the public school system. The vast majority, I mean, it's almost 700,000 students that go to traditional public schools and charters in Utah. So a lot of folks are concerned that, you know, you're not serving the majority of students here. You're not, you know, funding the public education system that educates the majority of kids in the state.
You had a very interesting question to end that kind of your omnibus story. Are vouchers effective? I guess, you know, if the purpose is to educate your child wherever they might be educated, children who are placed in private schools or wherever using voucher programs, do they test out equal or better than their peers?
This is a really tricky part of all of this. A lot of states don't allow for like data to be collected, for instance, like on their voucher programs, which is something that Utah is doing. So we're not really going to have a good sense with Utah's bill and the program that will be instituted if students, you know, do better in these private schools, if they decide to go to a private school and come back to the public system, if they're testing worse. We're not really going to get a sense of that. But some of the states that have implemented it and have tracked the data, I mean, pretty much across the board with them, I've seen scores drop. So like Louisiana, math and science scores dropped, Ohio and Indiana, similar results. You know, Milwaukee had a program where there was kind of the silver lining where students were more likely to graduate high school. But overall in the state, you know, test scores kind of bottomed out since the launch of these vouchers. So it's kind of across the board. Results aren't great. I mean, I think that it takes time for these programs to be in place. And I think, you know, proponents will tell you that you don't know for 3 to 5 years down the road, but the initial looks aren't great.
We're just about out of time for this segment, but I wanted to get this in. You report, I'll just read the headline, there's not enough interest in Utah's two existing vouchers programs to use up the money for them. Give me the 1 minute version of this. I guess they're leaving money on the table here.
Yeah, Utah has two existing voucher programs for special needs students. They're much smaller than this one that would be enacted, but already, you know, there's just not enough students applying for them to use up the money that's earmarked for them. So it essentially leaves millions of dollars just kind of sitting there untouched.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And our thanks to everyone who joined us. Earlier, we talked with State Watch reporters Emily Anderson Stern and Jacob Scholl and news columnist Robert Gerke. Our thanks, of course, again to Courtney Tanner. And thanks to you for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio.